Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, December 22nd, 2014. Just as I got behind the microphone today, I learned that Joe Cocker has died.
Baby, you understand me now. Sometimes you see that I'm mad. Don't you know no one alive can always be better when everything goes wrong.
Joe Cocker added his signature voice to many other people's great songs.
Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
And he was ridiculed by the late John Belushi for his hard living, hard drinking antics. But Joe Cocker got the last laugh. He survived till the age of 70, felled by lung cancer today, and last I heard, he was living in Santa Barbara, according to friends there who used to see him around at clubs and on the scene. Joe Cocker's voice will certainly be missed. Well, today I made a call to Bill Binney. He was once the technical director at the National Security Agency. As you probably well know, long before we ever heard of Ed Snowden, Bill Binney resigned in protest from the NSA back in 2001. And like many of his colleagues who once believed in the mission of the agency, he is now a whistleblower who fights to restore our constitutional rights. I wanted to ask Bill Binney for his thoughts about the Sony hack attack. And he had some very interesting remarks about the low level of security on corporate websites run by Sony and, oh gosh, Target, many other companies. Take a listen to what Bill Binney, who knows a lot more than I do, has to say.
Well, I think if they're permitted to be that way. I mean, once they discover a weakness, I don't think they tell them about it, so that way they don't fix it. So that means that they can capitalize on that weakness, like, for example, in any kind of system that's sold, operating system sold around the world, if they find a weakness in it or a firewall system or anything like that, if they find those weaknesses, they don't tell people because then when they're distributed and sold around the world, they can capitalize on those weaknesses wherever they're sold.
Mm-hmm.
So that allows them to get into systems all around the world. So their point is, but it also affects, of course, everybody in the United States. So if you keep all that secret, I mean, everybody's still vulnerable. The other part is there are two basic parts to NSA. One is offense, that's operations, and the other is defense, that's information assurance. So in other words, the one side is trying to protect the communications of the U.S. government primarily,
mm-hmm.
and the other is trying to break into systems that are basically they're trying to protect. So it's one arm is operating against the other, basically. So you get one trying to defend, the other trying to be offensive. To break in, the other trying to defend from break-ins. So they don't necessarily communicate well back and forth, and so therefore the weaknesses that exist might not be relayed to people who could actually try to help fix them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just internally in NSA now.
And would you argue that it is inappropriate for Mike Rogers, the new head of the NSA, to do as Keith Alexander did and also serve in a dual role as head of the Pentagon Cyber Command? Do you think there's a conflict there?
I don't really. I mean, they're very closely related things. I mean, the same data you use to do operations is the same you would do for cybersecurity. You need to be able to look at the same data. So that kind of information would be common to both operations. So I don't really see that as a conflict. I do think it's an awful lot of power to give any one person without any adequate oversight. And that's basically what the problem is. We don't have any court oversight or any congressional oversight that's effective at all. I mean, you can even just go back last year when Reggie Walton, who was the former senior judge on the FISA court,
mm-hmm.
after Snowden's revelations and when he published the Verizon court order from the FISA court, which was a general warrant giving 110+ million U.S. citizens data to NSA.
Yep.
Without stating who they are or what they're doing or why they're going for this information with any probable cause, which is a violation of the Fourth Amendment, also the First.
Yeah.
So But after that that was released, why he came out in August of 2013, which was about a month later, saying, well, we don't really have any real way of verifying the kinds of information we're getting from NSA or the FBI or anybody else, really. So he's really saying the court can only do a limited job when it comes to oversight, meaning look at the paperwork, make sure all the T's are crossed, the I's are dotted, all the paperwork's in order, and they have to basically assume that what they're being told by NSA or the FBI or CIA is true.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they know for a fact that that's not the case, because as early as August of 2002, the FISA court found out that the FBI had misrepresented facts in requesting at least 75 warrants.
Right.
So they knew they had a problem all along. They've never fixed it, and they still have that problem, and they're just helpless. I mean, it's not oversight at all. It's just paperwork, verification, that's all.
Right. Do you believe that our government has solid information that the hacks on Sony's web infrastructure did, in fact, originate in North Korea?
Well, I would think that they wouldn't say that unless they had certainly some information that verified that. I wouldn't assume anything other than the fact that they had some limited information. I mean, even if you try to disguise things, there's still ways of going through those devices to find out where things were originated and trace them back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's still ways of doing that, and I'm sure that they probably have some of that, and they know probably where exactly the attack came from. I would assume that.
All right. And do you put any validity in the denials that are now coming from the North Korean government?
No. Just like I don't put any validity in any denials coming from our government on what they're doing. I mean, they're all basically the same. It's the standard totalitarian process of misleading the public, getting them to think that they really know what they're doing, and they don't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, it's duping the public into thinking something's happening when it's not, and that's really keeping us an uninformed electorate, which is not really a democracy in my view.
Indeed. Now, while Bill Binney is not willing to say that he believes that the attack on Sony may not have come from North Korea, he's accepting the assertions of the FBI. You heard him go on to say that he doesn't believe either government. So now, kind of channeling OJ, remember when he said he was going to go find the real killer? Well, if you believe our government, then North Korea is now offering to partner with the United States to find the real hackers. And of course, I don't know who to believe here. But I am not convinced that the United States officials actually know who caused the hack at Sony. And a lot of people who are smarter than I have broken down the sequence of events. This group, the Guardians of Peace, using the initials GOP, they didn't really mention the film The Interview for quite a while after they started revealing their hack attacks on Sony. And so, you know, there are many questions that remain. And because we've seen the United States falsely assert, for example, that we knew, John Kerry said he knew 35 times, that Syria used chemical weapons in August of 2013, we have been told by our government flatly that we know that Russia was responsible for the shoot down of the Malaysian airliner over Ukraine, and serious questions remain. Well, like Bill Binney, I can't really put faith in either Pyongyang or Washington, and I will await further evidence. Now the U.S. has said we're asking China for help in blocking any future hack attacks coming from North Korea. All right. China has not responded to this unusual request. China is the closest ally of North Korea. And meanwhile, shortly after the president's press conference on Friday, what there is of an internet network in North Korea started to become unstable. Started to become unstable. And by today, the limited internet network in North Korea is completely dark. It is totally offline. Is the United States responsible for that? If we are, will we say so ever? Now, I mentioned how tiny the internet is. Average citizens don't have internet access in North Korea. And as an example, the country officially has just over 1,000 IP addresses when there are billions in the United States as a comparative. And there's very little commercial or government business conducted over the internet in North Korea, which makes our effort to hack them back, even if that is our desire, pretty difficult, pretty challenging. So it will be interesting to see how all this shakes out over the next few weeks. There are many angles to this story. Sony Pictures is fighting back, saying they had no choice because the theaters refused to show the film. They are looking for ways to distribute it online, maybe through Netflix. And of course, then Netflix will wonder, well, will we be the subjects of attacks? So this is a story that will probably continue well into the new year. I've done several interviews over the past 6 months with Yasha Levine, the talented investigative reporter at Pando.com. And in my most recent conversation about the Tor Anonymity Network, we learned that many of the backers of Tor were bashing, trashing, smearing Yasha Levine because of a story he published this past July, raising questions about the government funding that runs Tor, raising questions about its origins. Solid reporting on his part. And you can hear those interviews at BoilingFrogsPost.com in my Processing Distortion series. Well, now Pando reports that, it's not quite parallel to the timeline of the North Korean internet outage. But since last week, one of the founders of Tor, Roger Dingledine, posted an item. The Tor project has learned there may be an attempt to incapacitate our network in the next few days through the seizure of specialized servers in the network called directory authorities. And just today, Thomas White, who operates a large exit node cluster for the Tor network, reports that his servers have apparently been compromised. Quote, "Tonight there has been some unusual activity taking place, and I've now lost control of all servers under the ISP, and my account has been suspended. Having reviewed the last available information of the sensors, the chassis of the servers was opened, and an unknown USB device was plugged in only 30 to 60 seconds before the connection was broken. From experience, I know this trend of activity is similar to the protocol of sophisticated law enforcement who carry out search and seizure of running servers." So the Tor encryption network? Well, you can't trust it if that's how you buy your drugs or get your porn or conduct illicit activities. Or maybe you're just a privacy, you're very aggressive about guarding your privacy. In any case, you cannot rely on Tor at this time. Here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast, I rely on the contributions of listeners like you to support my work here. I rent servers. Mine haven't been compromised, to my knowledge. But it costs money to produce this podcast and deliver it to you every day. And I don't really make a living at this. I get paid a few thousand dollars a year, frankly, for hosting the 5 to 7 podcasts a week that I deliver to you. So I want to thank Alan Van Tress, a new annual subscriber, Tristan Wyatt, just signed up over the weekend. Dan Shannon is a long-term supporter of this podcast. And Kasita Kojo Amenya is a monthly subscriber, too. Thanks to each and every one of you. And you set a great example for others. Here in the holiday season, a lot of people do year-end giving. And if that's something that you're up to and you have the scratch to fund it, I would invite you to support my work. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the link right under my picture that says sign up. Choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers will be receiving before Christmas, if you have signed up by today, an ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's exciting new book, Empire of Chaos. And as we wrap up this year, I want to thank everyone who has supported my work in monetary ways, and also we've got people like Cassandra Troy and Carl Howard who like my podcasts and share them online every day, and I appreciate each and every one of you who supports my work. In September of 2011, as part of the Boiling Frogs podcast series that I was co-hosting with Sibel Edmonds, we interviewed Ray Novoshelsky and John Duffy. And they stuck their necks out and identified a CIA officer who is now a high-ranking agency official. And I received no repercussions, no blowback, no threats when we revealed the identity of Alfreda Frances Bukowski. She is the hot-headed, red-headed, pro-torture individual at the CIA who we're told was the model for the character, the lead character, in the movie Zero Dark Thirty. And Bukowski has a terrible track record. She was part of the crew that blew it before 9/11. And perhaps trying to compensate, when the gloves came off and Cheney invoked the dark side, Bukowski was right there. When torture was applied to Abu Zubaydah and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, we're told that Bukowski was right there, right in the room, egging them on, if not pouring water herself. She is the individual who is, we're told, responsible for the whole bungled operation that took Khalid El-Masri, a German citizen, into American custody. He was tortured by the CIA in Afghanistan, and then they dropped him off on a road in Macedonia when they decided, whoops, we've got the wrong guy. And to his credit, Glenn Greenwald refused to play the game, and he refused to honor requests from the CIA in the past week not to identify Alfreda Frances Bukowski. But Greenwald had the same reaction as I did to the silly game being played by NBC News and, regrettably, The New Yorker magazine and its great reporter, Jane Mayer. Because last week, both of them talked about Bukowski, but they refused to name her. Mayer dubbed her the unidentified queen of torture. NBC News called her the a key apologist for the CIA's torture program, but they both honored requests from the CIA not to link her history and her dossier to her name. And so I have great respect for Glenn Greenwald for taking this step. Over the weekend, I saw that others researched real estate records in suburban Virginia, suburban Washington, D.C., and actually published the home address of Alfreda Frances Bukowski. Now, I don't feel a need to do that, but I refuse to play this game that a person who is not a covert operator, who is simply being protected because her fingerprints were all over the torture program of the CIA. She's one of those who should have been purged a long time ago, but by any means should have been purged after the torture report was released. And the ACLU is correctly calling for an end to the obstruction of justice articulated by President Obama, looking forward, not backward, and some real investigations and prosecutions for the clear lawbreaking that took place. WikiLeaks is at it again. They've released two classified documents. These are internal, kind of magazine-style presentations made available to covert operatives of the CIA on how to get around global security systems in international airports. Now, isn't this rich? Okay? It's the spook agencies that have imposed the draconian political theater security systems at our airports today, which I believe are designed in part to telegraph fear to the traveling public in order to justify all of the other police state tactics. So the manual tells covert people who are going through secondary screening that it's important to have a consistent, well-rehearsed, and plausible cover. And it even tells them how to deal with biometric databases. And Julian Assange at WikiLeaks says, under the Obama administration, these documents show that the CIA is still intent on infiltrating European Union borders and conducting clandestine operations in EU member states. Late Friday, it was announced that four more prisoners from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have been released. These are four Afghan citizens who have been returned to Afghanistan. And what's fascinating about this is the New York Times report on this says that the release of these four men was done rather rapidly at the request of the new president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani. Now, you would think that if leaders of influential nations who are believed to be allies of the United States pressed the Obama administration for the release of their nationals from Guantanamo, that it might happen. And as you know, I'm supporting the British-based campaign to win the release of the last Briton held at Guantanamo, Shaker Amer. So when I saw this article in Sunday's New York Times, with the reference to this special request from the Afghan president, I put up a post on the We Stand With Shaker Amer Facebook page, linking to the New York Times story, and a message addressed, "Dear David Cameron, why don't you try asking your friend Barack Obama for the immediate release of Shaker Amer?" Marcy Wheeler, who is a great online journalist, who's been publishing at Empty Wheel. She briefly had a dalliance with Glenn Greenwald and the gang at Pierre Omidyar's First Look publication online. But today she published an important story at Al Jazeera America. She has sifted through the Senate torture report, and she's focused on a specific time frame in 2004. After the Abu Ghraib pictures were revealed, the U.S., at that point, did stop torturing, or they put an end officially to the torture program. On June 4th of that year, following a May Inspector General report that was critical of the interrogation program, George Tenet suspended it. But within weeks, based on phony information extracted from a suspect, which pointed to threats of an Al-Qaeda attack timed with the November 2004 presidential election, George Tenet was demanding that the authority be restored. And it was. John Ashcroft, who was still the Attorney General, signed off, and this was, of course, after that bizarre event in the hospital where he refused to extend the Stellar Wind collection of our cell phone data. Most of that was later reversed. But it is fascinating because the two detainees were named Gull. One was G-H-U-L, the other spelled his name G-U-L. And it turns out that the information from both of these gulls, I don't know, I'll refrain from making a pun about seagulls, but you can. It seems that they were used as convenient tools to reinstate the torture program against the non-existent threat of an Al-Qaeda attack in November of 2004. And we know, in hindsight, that that didn't happen. Jason Leopold has made a year-end contribution to what are called the Vice News Awards, and he delves into some of the bizarre language that is officially used at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. For example, he says if a detainee attempts suicide, it's called self-injurious behavior. Shackles are referred to as humane restraints. Force feeding is now called enteral feeding, which replaced assisted feeding. He notes even the use of detainee, which I generally avoid, as opposed to prisoner, is carefully thought out. But to him, the one that takes the prize is the conversion of hunger striking to the euphemistic term long-term non-religious fasts. There are a few others here. Hunger strike has been scrubbed from the documents at Guantanamo and replaced with medical management of detainees with weight loss. And Leopold notes that former guards at Guantanamo told him that euphemisms are used to ensure that the prisoners are not viewed by the public or the media as human beings. Oh, and the last one here? They have a detainee program called intellectual stimulation, which means they're given books, magazines, puzzles, and newspapers. Great. Why can't we just call it a reading program? Well, over the weekend, two New York police officers who were sitting in a patrol car in Brooklyn were shot dead by a man from Baltimore. The suspect then went and killed himself. His name was Ismael Brinsley. He reportedly shot a girlfriend in Baltimore, got on a bus to New York after blasting out on social media that he wanted to kill him some cops. So obviously this is a disturbed guy. But he invoked the names of Michael Brown and Eric Garner in his statements on social media about killing some cops. And this has produced white rage from New York City like I haven't seen in a while. And it is truly disgusting when you hear a guy who is so discredited like Rudolph Giuliani, the former mayor, go on, of course, the Fox News channel and say we've had 4 months of propaganda starting with the president that everybody should hate the police. The president has never said that, never come close. And this, of course, is just the kind of bizarre hysterical spin that cop lovers who can't acknowledge when cops do bad things, when they kill innocent black men unnecessarily. This is the language they resort to. We got Patrick Lynch, president of the union there, the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, who within hours of the shootings declared that there was blood on the hands of demonstrators and elected officials who have criticized police tactics. And now Mayor de Blasio is appealing to protesters to suspend their actions. He says, put aside protests. That can be for another day. Well, Mr. Mayor, you may have a decent idea there. But before you tell communities of color who have a real basis for their outrage at the treatment of Brown and Garner and many other men who don't have that notoriety, will you please sit on Rudy Giuliani and tell Patrick Lynch to shut the fuck up? Because they are openly trying to generate, in my view, a race war. One of the pro-police people described this in warlike terms and says that, you know, there's been a war on the police and now the police are going to fight back in kind. That's not how it works in our country. And we have police departments who are, they have way too much power, and we know that. And I fault the president for not offering more leadership. At the news conference on Friday, he did talk about race relations. But like so many other things, he refers to a conversation. You know, we had a conversation about torture, and nothing has changed. We had a conversation about wiretapping, and all that surveillance is still going on. And he talks about the conversation on race, but have we addressed the issues of runaway grand juries, of cops who shoot to kill when they don't need to, and of the extreme racial profiling that the president himself has acknowledged. There's an interview that's going to be published this week. I saw a teaser. I think it's People magazine. And I was pretty touched when Obama said, yeah, you know, I went to an event dressed in a tux, and I'm standing out there waiting for my car to be brought up by the valet, and somebody arrives and assumes I'm the valet and hands me their keys. And from what I can tell, that happened while he was a U.S. senator. And so Obama is aware of the daily indignities that black Americans face. And let's note that this guy, Brinsley from Baltimore, he shot a Latino cop and an Asian cop. And what we're hearing is a bunch of white people expressing their outrage and falsely accusing the president and the demonstrators, the vast majority of whom have been peaceful and law-abiding, that they are responsible for this crazy guy who invoked Garner and Brown as he killed two cops and then took his own life. No one, including Al Sharpton, who I don't have much respect for, can be blamed, you know, that they are in some way responsible that a lunatic decided to do this. But that's how it will be played on Fox News and with the cop-loving elite, particularly in New York City. A friend on Facebook shared this new song from Michael Franti and Spearhead. They're a real treasure from here in San Francisco. It was just released a few days ago, and already 45,000 people have viewed it on YouTube. I'll throw up the link so that you can do the same. But for now, I'd like you to listen to the audio of this song. It's not as if I think Michael Franti's song is going to make any big, big difference. But it might soothe some people at a troubled time. The song is called Same As It Ever Was, Michael Franti and Spearhead.
But there's gotta be a better way. It's the same as it ever was, but today's a different day. You and me couldn't make that change, but it's the same as it ever was. We better start today.
Thanks for listening. I'm Peter B. Collins.
A better place than it was 50 years ago. There's been a whole lot of change, but we got a long way to go. When we used to have a problem, we used to call the police. But who we gonna call when the police make a problem? I'm not saying that they all bad. I'm not saying that I'm any better. All I'm just trying to say is we could all do a lot better. I say it in my own house, and I say it on the street. I say it on the record, y'all, and I say it on the beat. I paint it on the wall, y'all, so that everybody sees. When we all see justice, then we'll all see peace.
It's the same as it ever was, but there's gotta be a better way. It's the same as it ever was, but today's a different day. As it ever was, we better start today.
A revolution is a battle between the future and the past. The battle's never over, but the future's gonna last. Malcolm had an X, yo, and the king had a dream. And like Spike Lee said, yo, you should always do the right thing. If the world's full of anger and everybody's got a gun, then what should I say, yo, to my teenage son? Mandela did lockdown for 28 years, but there's millions more, y'all, still raining down tears. I say it in my own house, and I say it on the street.
RCP.